And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Marcia Bartusiak, who has written Dispatches from Planet 3, Tales of the Solar System, the Milky Way, and Beyond. The 32 concise and fascinating essays, the author provides a deeper understanding of the nature of the universe and those who strive to uncover its mysteries. Bartusiak shares the backstories for many momentous astronomical discoveries, including the contributions of such pioneers as Beatrice Tinsley and her groundbreaking research in galactic evolution, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, the scientist who first discovered radio pulsars, and many others. Marcia Bartusiak, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be with you, John and Lynn.
It's really nice to have you on the program because your book is really written for Cool Science Radio, the curious layperson. We have textbooks, we have books that really go into a lot of theory on a single subject. They're 200-300 pages long. This is broken into 32 vignettes, and it's not so heavy in science that you get lost, but at the same time, it has the backstories, the human stories of how these things happened. Many of our listeners, well, Lynn and I are both curious lay people, and many of our listeners are as well. Tell us how this book came together.
Well, for the last several years, I have been writing a regular column for Natural History magazine, and this was the intention. The column is called Cosmic Background. And what I do is I take something that is currently in the news, and I pull back and try to show more about how that idea or finding came to be. What is the backstory behind that discovery and that finding? For example, when Pluto was demoted from planet to dwarf planet, I point out that this actually happened before in the 19th century when asteroid Ceres, when it was first discovered, it was declared to be a planet and for many, many years was listed in the textbooks as a planet. And then it later got demoted when they came to see that it was really part of a larger conglomeration that came to be known as the asteroid belt. So this is what I've been trying to do for the last several years. And finally, with enough columns under my belt, I put them into a collection.
Well, I learned a lot from reading your book, including about Ceres, and of course, I'm still heartbroken about Pluto. But I learned a lot of other things, like from Hubble, for an example, that we had learned that he was responsible for understanding the expansion of the universe. And so in your book, you have stories of Jorge Lemaître and Vesto Slipher, and I hope I haven't mispronounced their names.
It's a Vesto Slipher,
okay,
and
Slipher.
Georges Lemaître. Yes, it turns out that, you know, we identify so much, it's in all the textbooks, that Hubble discovered the expanding universe. But it's really a far deeper story than that. And these two people, Georges Lemaître and Vesto Slipher, actually played very important roles in our discovery that the universe is expanding. In fact, as I point out in that chapter, Hubble was a little devious. His famous paper in 1929, in which he showed that the galaxies were uniformly moving outward in a certain way. He had a famous graph where on one axis he had the distance to the various galaxies, and on the other axis the velocity of those galaxies. Well, Hubble, he is the one who got all the distance information. He had measured the distances to all these galaxies. But the velocity information all came from an earlier paper by Vesto Slipher, who was an astronomer at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona. And Hubble used Slipher's data without any
recognition.
He did not cite Slipher's paper. It made it seem as if he had done the velocity data. And so we call the rate at which the universe expands the Hubble constant. Well, in my mind, it really should be the Hubble-Slipher constant.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe you should have a space telescope named after him, huh?
Yeah, we should have the Hubble Slipher telescope, shouldn't we? And Georges Lemaître, actually, 2 years before Hubble, he had actually done the same thing. He had put together the distance information and Slipher's velocity information, and he came up with the expansion 2 years before Hubble. He is the first one who wrote a paper actually saying that the universe was expanding. Unfortunately, he wrote this paper in an obscure Belgian journal in French that no one read. And Lemaître was not someone to blow his horn. He didn't really go out and spread the idea. So his paper was not recognized until after Hubble did his work. And then finally, at that point, everyone came to understand that what Hubble had discovered was the expanding universe.
Mm. It seems as though in those times you sort of had to be a big self-promoter and a celebrity scientist to have your name placed on brilliant new discoveries. And I think the movement, and this is sort of a compliment to this sort of book that you have written, is that today there seems to be a trend in discovering those lesser told stories and the people who never got recognized until now. And along those lines, I love to hear the stories of women who were in the background, who really never got their names placed on things. And talk, if you would, about this housewife, who chased galaxies, Beatrice Tinsley.
Yeah, this is something that it was only after the fact, because as I said, while I was writing these columns, they were each separate, and I was only following the agenda of a new finding coming out and then providing the backstory. And it was only when I put all of the columns together that I suddenly realized how many women I had in this book, and women that are not in textbooks, such as Beatrice Tinsley. I was very pleased to see that there are so many women who were at the forefront of some of the major ideas in science. Vera Rubin, who provided the best evidence that dark matter exists in the universe. Jocelyn Bell, who discovered the neutron star, and yet her advisor got the Nobel Prize for it. Henrietta Leavitt, who provided the cosmic yardstick, the means by which Hubble was able to measure out and discover that the Milky Way was not alone, that there were other galaxies. And Beatrice Tinsley, she had a background in physics, and she was originally from New Zealand, but moved to the United States when her husband, also a scientist, got a job in Texas. And she decided she'd get her Ph.D. in cosmology, which had been a personal interest of hers. And no one really wanted to work with her because she had a background in solid-state physics. But the University of Texas at Austin took a chance, and they allowed her to do her Ph.D. And she chose a very interesting topic. Astronomers at this time were using galaxies as markers to see how fast the universe was expanding, to keep measuring it, to determine ultimately, is the universe open or closed? Is it going to, are the galaxies slowing down that at some point they're going to come back in a big crunch? But this assumes when you're using galaxies as these markers that they don't change. And if they change, well, that changes the ball game. And she decided to study that. And she did a computer simulation and did indeed prove that galaxies evolve, which was a very controversial statement at that time. Everyone assumed that galaxies didn't change much over their age, that they all sort of looked much like the Milky Way. But indeed, she showed that galaxies were much more active in their early years and then aged, bluer in the past, and then as they cooled down and got older, they got redder and redder. And at first, astronomers pushed back against this idea, but eventually it became one of the most important ideas in galactic studies. And she really started the field of galactic, studying the evolution of galaxies.
And at the same time, the evolution of galaxies is unfolding. The evolution of women being recognized in science is evolving. And in the case of Beatrice Tinsley, her name now is appearing on all of these scientific studies, which eventually leads her into being offered a professorship at Yale University in the mid-70s, which sounds fairly modern day, but really I bet at that time there weren't many women professors at...
Not at all. And I say kudos to Yale University for recognizing what she had done, because she did try right after her PhD to get some sort of university appointment and failed. But it was that her work was starting to be cited more and more, and some astronomers were able to finally get the observational evidence to show that what she had predicted was true. They had found galaxies in the past that were bluer and more active than those around us today. And that built up her reputation. Unfortunately, though, she died very young. She wasn't able to continue her work very long. She got melanoma and eventually died of cancer. But she... in the hospital, was working up to her last days, putting the last touches to her final published paper, which was published without any revision or edits on the part of the journal editors.
Wow, that's a great story. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Marcia Bartusiak, who has written Dispatches from Planet 3, 32 Tales on the Solar System, the Milky Way, and beyond. I'd like to go back for a moment to Henrietta Swan Leavitt, which is Chapter 24, Finding a Cosmic Yardstick. 20 years ago, I was taking night classes at Harvard Astrophysics on 60 Garden Street, right outside of Harvard Square, a couple blocks outside, and I think just about a mile or so from where you're located at MIT. And Dr. Eric Chazon was my professor. And after our class, it was a night class, we would sit around and have a bite to eat, a bunch of us, and we always talked about something different after each class. And on this one night, we were talking about the women of Harvard astrophysics, the 500,000 glass plates over a 130-year period, and he took us back into one of the rooms on 60 Garden Street and showed us some of the glass plates, and he told the story of Henrietta Leavitt and how, I mean, these women were paid a fraction of what men would have been paid. And
25 cents an hour.
Yeah, they worked tirelessly, and a lot of their accomplishments were not stolen, it was just the thing at the time, were you know, the accomplishments were grabbed by the men.
Not all of them. Some of them did get their due. Annie Jump Cannon is well connected with having established the standard astronomical spectrum, of how to the various stellar categories. And Henrietta Leavitt is getting her due. They now talk about what was known as the period luminosity law for Cepheid variables. They now call it the Leavitt law. So as Lynn pointed out, slowly but surely, we're starting to get to give these women and these unsung heroes some credit.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a question about George Lemaître. Is that his?
Lemaître, yes.
Lemaître. His boss was Lowell, the guy that the city was named after, Lowell, Massachusetts. And he had a big ego and he had a lot of influence. Why did he allow his protege, or the person that did most of the work for him?
Vesto Slipher is the one who worked for Percival Lowell at the Lowell Observatory, yes.
Why didn't Lowell help Slipher get the credit that he deserved?
Partly because Lowell was very much an egotist who was really more focused on his own work and not the work of his underlings.
Okay.
And not to mention, Slipher got started on studying the velocities of what were then known as spiraling nebulae before they were fully known as galaxies for another reason altogether. Lowell was an expert in planetary astronomy, and he was sure that the spiraling nebulae were baby solar systems in the making right here in our Milky Way. And he wanted Slipher to take the spectra so that he could show that the composition of those spiraling nebulae were very comparable to the spectra of the planets in our solar system to prove that they were baby solar systems in the making. And what happened was Slipher instead was showing that these spiraling nebulae were something totally different altogether and likely outside the Milky Way. So probably once Slipher found out that, Lowell probably didn't become interested anymore because it was not an area of astronomy that he dealt with. He was really just focused on the solar system.
That's interesting. Well, sticking with that Lowell name, I didn't even realize that, you know, the wealthy Lowell family that, you know, anyone who's been to Boston or Massachusetts knows the name, and a very wealthy family in the textile industry. But Percival Lowell was very interested in exploring Mars and went out to Flagstaff, Arizona, I believe, and had the telescope. And he ended up with some very bold theories about Mars. And he would love to hear about all of the exploration and what we've discovered with the Mars Curiosity rover and the canals that he came up with, which are really, I mean, I wonder just how accurate he really was.
He wasn't accurate at all. he was influenced. It was actually other astronomers in Europe who had seen these linear streaks on the surface of Mars when they were doing their observations. And there was one Italian astronomer who had called them canali, which actually in Italian was channels. And he did think it was a geologic process. He'd never thought that they were actually involved water in any way. But once that those papers came over to America, Lowell and others interpreted it as canals, actual
right.
watery canals.
That had been constructed.
Yes, and Lowell just he just took that idea and ran with it and started, in fact, built his observatory in Flagstaff solely to start focusing on getting better and better information about Mars. And the trouble, though, is it's very difficult to observe Mars when you are looking through a telescope. And remember, he initially did his studies solely with the eye, no photographs. You're getting these glimpses in between all the turbulent atmosphere. And he was literally sort of making it up and sort of imagining that there were these linear streaks across Mars. It was an optical illusion. But he built up this whole story, wrote many books about how these were likely irrigation canals that were siphoning water from the melting ice at the poles down to the rest of the planet. And this was front page news. In fact, at one point, the newspapers, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, declared it the finding of the year about life on Mars. But the astronomical community, though, couldn't stand his work and tried to avoid any mention of it in the official journals. They would not accept his papers in the professional journals.
Well, I'm curious about how often that sort of thing would happen where these maybe, well, it's not that he was a pseudoscientist. He was a scientist. He graduated from Harvard. But, you know, these people who had vast economic resources who would project their, you know, quote unquote, findings and and really influence the scientific community or popular belief. You know, it seems to me that that went on a lot more back. I mean, that was the late 1800s,
early 1900s. I think he was the exception. Many other wealthy men did support astronomy, but only financially. There was Yerkes, who founded the Yerkes, or funded the Yerkes Observatory. It was really founded by George Ellery Hale. But they were mainly funding it. They wanted their name on the biggest telescopes in the world. James Lick and the Lick Observatory, again, wanted their name on the biggest telescopes in the world. So more often the case was the big wealthy men would fund, and then the scientists would be allowed to use those instruments in a much more scientific way. Percival Lowell was an exception. He used his personal funds to carry out his own ideas. He did some valid work. Mars was sort of an exception, but he did some other valid work in planetary studies. He, like you said, was an intelligent man, but he had his own agenda, and he had some crazy ideas mixed in with some other things that he did that were more valid.
Mm-hmm. Marcia, you teach science writing at MIT, Massachusetts Institute for Technology. What are some of the major takeaways that you want your students to know? And I believe it's at a graduate level that you teach this course or these courses about good science writing.
Well, the number one thing I tell them from the start is they're not there to teach science, but to allow people to get a feel for the science. There's no way that you can take an entire textbook and turn it into 1,000 words. What you want to do is find the stories that will draw the audience in, and then you're bringing the science in along the way. And you are really focusing on the metaphors and analogies that will allow them to understand scientific processes in ways they can understand, that something acts like something else. You know, the sun is rotating, spinning like a top, or a black hole takes in matter, you know, swirling around it like matter in a whirlpool. You're giving them a feel for the mechanism. You're not necessarily teaching them the actual physical laws. And that, I mean, for a lay audience, they don't have the background to start from square one, but you can give them a feel for the physical laws, and that's what I am always telling my students. Also, sniff out for those fun stories to blend the human story with the science so that you're telling a story. It's storytelling.
Boy, that's great advice. Great advice. So you're obviously a curious person, and I wanted to ask you, what one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet? And you can pick any field you want, Marcia.
I really want to know what the dark matter is. I have been covering this story since 1982. My first story on it was in 1982. And then it wasn't even known as dark matter. It was called missing mass. What is the missing mass
exactly.
of the universe? And I have been doing stories on this for more than 30 years. And darn it, I want to know what it is.
Do you think we're close? I mean, I read recently about these very small particles, and they have to go way underground to be able to measure them. They're hoping to measure them, and they think that they have a role in. I mean, you know, what's your sense of, I mean, are we heading in any direction that may get us some sort of conclusion on that?
It's still very much a mystery because, back in 1993, I published a book on the dark matter question, and I was talking about scientists that were just beginning to put these detectors underground to try to find unknown particles that we have not yet discovered. And they're still doing that. And the experiments have gotten more and more sophisticated. They thought for sure that the instruments that they were developing were now sensitive enough to discover the particles that they had theorized. But nothing, zip, nothing has come up yet. Very, very surprising. So either the particle is even more devious in hiding itself than we know, or it's another explanation altogether. Right now, I'm still putting my money on it being an undiscovered particle, but who knows what we're going to find out in coming years.
Well, Marcia, I just want to thank you for the work that you do. You know, as a science program, we get solicitations from a lot of people who send us their books who are trying to make science, you know, accessible. And yet you'll open up the book and it, you know, it might be called something like How Soccer Relates to Math. And there'll be these formulas that a layperson will just never understand. And I just think it's so valuable when science can really be brought to the masses. And I think about, you know, the Imitation Game that became the film and Hidden Figures that became the film, that really, it really brings us, and that's really what your work is. And so I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
So dispatches from Planet 3, the 32 tales on the solar system, the Milky Way, and beyond. Marcia Bartusiak is the author. You know, Lynn, I'm thinking this would be a good Christmas book. This would be a good Christmas present.
It would.
Yeah.
For the science curious.
You can pick a story, a night, and go through
them.
Marcia, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's been a delight, John and Lynn.